I am Plant on the Line here at thecommentary.ca. One of the themes that's come up with guests this season on the interview program is Canada, how we perceive ourselves and how we're perceived around the world. I'm thinking of my conversations with Roy McGregor and Andrew Cohen. While McGregor looks to the past at the myths we've created and Cohen at how we nation build in the present, today I talk with Dr. Michael Byers, who looks beyond our borders and how Canada asserts its independence and how it conducts its foreign policy. He looks to the future in his new book, Intent for a Nation, What is Canada For?, published by Douglas and McIntyre. The book retails for $32.95. Michael Byers holds the Canada Research Chair in Global Politics and International Law at the University of British Columbia. He is also the Academic Director of the Liu Institute for Global Issues. He was a Professor of Law and Canadian Studies at Duke and was a Fellow at Oxford. His previous books include Custom, Power, and the Power of Rules, and War Law. I am pleased to welcome to the Plant on the Line program Michael Byers. Good morning, Professor Byers.
Oh, good morning. It's very good to be here.
Thanks for joining us. You opened the book with the story of how you, I guess you were at Duke, and you were working there with a green card. You were 4.5 years into that. You could have had your American citizenship in half a year, but you decided to give that up. What did that mean to you then, and I guess what were you trying to symbolically do?
Well, it wasn't simply a symbolic gesture. It was also simple compliance with U.S. law. I had chosen to move back to Canada to leave the United States, and so I was no longer a permanent resident of the United States and therefore required to surrender my green card. However, most Canadians in that situation don't surrender their green card, and I made the conscious choice to do so, mostly because I knew that I was moving to Canada for good, that this was a permanent move. I was coming home, and so there was no question of leaving my options open. But added to that was a symbolic element, a very personal element, in that having spent a total of 12 years outside the United States, having seen what it is like to live in other countries, not just the United States, but also the United Kingdom and Germany, that this was my place. This is where I belonged. And so surrendering my green card was an affirmation of my connection, my love for this country. And as I say in the introduction to the book, I realized as I was doing it that I was actually making a choice that that millions of Canadians have made. Those Canadians who were born outside of Canada and came here and naturalized as Canadians. But for the rest of us, for the 27, 28 million of us who were born here, we've never had to make that choice. And I was, in my own way, making that choice. This was me committing to Canada, committing to this place.
Well, the other neat thing about this book, you discuss some of the success and the accomplishments that Canadians have had, the Canadian government has had in influencing foreign policy. People in this country tend to regard ourselves as a middle power, sort of have these self-defeating thoughts and underestimate ourselves. Talk to me about some of the things that you found in writing this book, some of those success stories in how we've been able to influence quite substantial things in terms of foreign policy.
Yes, in some respects, I've been affected by my time in the United States. This is an American book about Canada, and that it's a very optimistic, kind of get-things-done book. I'm not someone who wants to dwell on the past or to look at the glass as half empty. I want to look at the glass as half full, and in a deliberately provocative way, I want to shake Canadians up a little bit, point out that we're actually a powerful country. And we're a powerful country for a whole host of reasons. The fact that we have the eighth largest economy on the planet, that we have the second largest chunk of real estate. And also, as you said, we've exercised real influence in the past. We played a very significant role in encouraging the development of the International Atomic Energy Agency and the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty by choosing, as a member of the Manhattan Project, to not acquire nuclear weapons ourselves. we played a decisive role in bringing peace to the Middle East in 1956 during the Suez Crisis when Lester Pearson won the Nobel Peace Prize. We, at that time, pioneered the concept of UN peacekeeping. And more recently, we played a very important role in the development of the International Criminal Court, the Landmines Convention, and more recently, a convention for the protection of cultural diversity. When we try, when we believe in ourselves, we actually matter. We're not, you know, just another small country. We're not even just a middle power country. We're actually a big, powerful country. And if we didn't exist in the shadow of the world's most powerful country, I think more Canadians would realize that.
Afghanistan. We are in Afghanistan. Your suggestion in the book is that we should pull out, that we're digging a hole, and we should stop. Prime Minister Harper, I guess over a year ago, said that, you know, Canadians aren't quitters or cowards, and that we don't cut and run at the first sign of trouble. You say we're beyond the first sign of trouble.
Yes, and let's be clear. I don't think that Canada should abandon Afghanistan. Afghanistan's a big place, and there's a lot of good that we could do in that country. But the vast majority of our efforts are going into a counterinsurgency mission in Kandahar province, the most dangerous part of that large country. And it's a mission that's extremely aggressive. It mirrors the tactics of the U.S. Army in Iraq. And it's designed to essentially search and kill the Taliban, Al-Qaeda remnants, other insurgents. It's not a role that Canada is particularly well suited for, and it's not a role that's consistent with what we've been doing since the Suez Crisis in 1956. Our soldiers are pretty good, and they're very brave, and I salute them for their efforts, but the choice of this particular mission is one that I have very serious doubts about, and I'm also concerned, on top of that, as to what we're not able to do elsewhere because of our commitment to this particular mission. What we're not able to do elsewhere in Afghanistan, or what we might not be able to do in, let's say, Darfur, or what we might not be able to do with the $1.5 billion a year that we're spending on that counterinsurgency mission. And what I would like to see, and what I'm trying to encourage in this book, is a very careful national assessment of the complexity and of the risks involved in this particular mission, so that we can begin to answer some of the really important questions, like, for instance, why have 21 of the 26 NATO countries refused to deploy into the south? Do we necessarily have to assume that they're cowards, or perhaps have they analyzed the situation more carefully than us and realized that this is not a mission that can succeed?
Well, when was it, where was it, that Canada sort of moved from this role of being peacemaker, or peacekeeper, pardon me, to being war maker?
It's a role that has evolved, and I don't want to put the blame on any particular prime minister or any particular government or party. We saw this move towards more war fighting as in part a response to declining defense budgets, as the Department of National Defense and the Canadian Forces sought to tie themselves ever more closely to the U.S. military, knowing that interoperability with U.S. forces demanded sizable defense budgets, and therefore was a way of countering the efforts to reduce those budgets in Ottawa. But a very important step did occur during Paul Martin's government, when the decision was made to take Canadian forces away from a traditional peacekeeping operation in Kabul, the capital city of Afghanistan, and move them to Kandahar into a counterinsurgency mission to establish what's called a battle group, and to fight side by side with U.S. and British forces in this much more aggressive mission. And that has been, I guess, conducive of a change in attitude and rhetoric on the part of both our political and military leaders. And the most, I think, of the defense staff, Rick Hillier, when he called the enemy scumbags and murderers, and in doing so undermined Canada's efforts at diplomacy, not just in Afghanistan, but across the broader Islamic world.
This builds into your response to terrorism, because terrorism seems to be this war that we seem to be all fighting throughout the world. Your response to that is just perhaps to relax, take a deep breath, and exhale. Why?
Well, I think that although terrorism is a serious problem, it's a threat which has been exaggerated by people who want to use that threat to pursue an agenda that they already have. And perhaps the most blatant example of this is how the administration of George W. Bush seized upon the attacks of September 11, 2001, not to justify a coordinated police response involving police investigations and judicial cooperation across borders, but to frame the response as the global war on terror, and to argue that the world had fundamentally changed, and that the Geneva Conventions no longer applied, and that the response to a lack of cooperation on the part of the Iraqi government was to invade a foreign sovereign country on the basis of the possibility that they might one day cooperate with terrorists in the context of weapons of mass destruction. This is not a book about the Bush administration, but the Bush administration has influenced the way that Canadian governments think about foreign policy in some pretty negative ways. And one way it has done so is to allow this language, this rhetoric of the war on terrorism to creep into Canadian decision-making and the Canadian public debate. We haven't surrendered to this rhetorical move in the same way that our American neighbors have, but it is important for Canadians to realize that terrorism is a problem that's been around since time immemorial. It's a danger, it's a police problem, it's something that you seek to prevent, that you manage. But if you allow yourself to be terrorized, the terrorists win. And so the response should be measured, it should be calm, and it should be one that avoids, wherever possible, escalation, particularly into armed conflict, because, again, that's what the terrorists want us to do.
Does your prescription, in terms of handling terrorism, include negotiating with terrorists like the Taliban, for example, or Al-Qaeda?
It includes leaving the option open. And I say that very carefully because I don't want to support terrorism in any way. I have lived in countries that were subject to terrorist attack while I was there. The impact of terrorism has actually come relatively close to me, and it is a horrific thing, and it is to be condemned. But as Winston Churchill once said, jaw, jaw is always better than war, war. And the fact of the matter is that people do negotiate with terrorists. Gerry Adams, Sinn Féin, the IRA, the whole experience in Northern Ireland and the Good Friday Agreement and the bringing of a power-sharing government to Belfast just in the last few months is an indication of how a willingness to talk can sometimes bring great dividends. Or to give you another example, Nelson Mandela and the ANC were regarded as terrorists by many people, but negotiations in the end brought an end to the violence. And that is something that should be our utmost goal, not to support terrorism, not to excuse or justify it in any way, but to recognize that opening channels of communication can, in some instances, be the best way forward in terms of avoiding the loss of innocent lives.
This hysteria around terrorism and sort of the fear-mongering that's gone on with it, have you seen in Canada the same sort of trampling of civil liberties and so on in this country, whether here or abroad, by Canadians?
I've had the great honor of spending some time with Meher Arar, and Monya Bazig, his wife, his extraordinary wife, who managed to draw the attention of the Canadian public to his plight and secure his release. Yeah, we've been at the front line in terms of the war on terror in respect of what's happened to some of our citizens. And the story of Meher Arar and how the Canadian people rallied to his cause to force the exercise of diplomatic pressure, the establishment of a commission of inquiry, and eventually the resignation of the commissioner of the RCMP is a story that I find both cautionary and actually quite heartening. Cautionary because we can make mistakes. We have made mistakes in this country in terms of getting the balance right between seeking to manage and prevent terrorism on the one hand and protecting our way of life and our civil liberties on the other. We've got that balance wrong before. But the Canadian people also demonstrated that they have pretty cool heads and as a collectivity wanted to see these wrongs redressed. And we saw it again in the summer of 2006 when 17 men and boys were arrested in Toronto, alleged with plotting terrorist attacks. And they may well be guilty of those offenses. But when the national media sought to ratchet this up to sort of our own 9/11 and the media coverage focusing on terrorism and potential targets and everything else, after roughly 3 or 4 days of this hyperventilating on the part of the national media, they stopped. The media stopped. And the simple explanation is that Canadians weren't terrorized. They actually were reassured by the fact that the RCMP and CSIS had identified these alleged plotters a year in advance and had ensured that they never got anywhere close to the point of posing an actual threat. So I'm quite encouraged by the way that the Canadian public has behaved on the issue of terrorism. I think it says a lot about the very many international connections that Canadians have and the very high immigration rate which we have, which means that millions of Canadians have pretty serious experience with the reality of terrorism and know, as I've said already, that if you allow yourselves to be terrorized, the terrorists win.
I'm talking with Michael Byers from UBC, the author of Intent for a Nation, 3295 from Douglas and McIntyre. Switching gears to climate change, which is of great import around the world, do you think Canada can make a positive contribution in solving this climate change problem? And do you think that this current regime, that the Conservative government, can make a positive contribution?
Well, the first thing to say is that Canadians need to realize that we're on the front line of climate change. 40% of this country is Arctic, and the Arctic is suffering the impact of climate change in a much greater, more accelerated fashion than anywhere else on Earth. I saw this with my own eyes in October 2006 when I sailed through the Northwest Passage on the Canadian Research Icebreaker, the Atmundsen, and we found almost no ice the end of October in the Northwest Passage, and the 40 climate change scientists on board were collectively terrified by the almost complete absence of ice. Climate change is real. It's impacting on very important, very large areas of this country already to the detriment of the environment, to the detriment of the people who live there. And the other respect in which we're on the front line is that we are one of the very worst per capita emitters of greenhouse gases on the planet. And we are by far the worst violator or projected violator of the Kyoto Protocol commitments. When the Kyoto Protocol commitments kick in next year, in the 2008 to 2012 phase, we're likely to be 30% over where we promised to be. And so, you know, we are both victims and we are an important part of the cause. And as I've said already, we're an important country. We're a very wealthy country. We are the only G8 country with balanced books apart from oil-rich Russia. And so if we wanted to, we could actually provide a pretty serious role model for the rest of the world as to how a highly developed country could move through the next industrial revolution and turn away from fossil fuels and develop alternative energy technologies while taking very serious measures to conserve. We could do it. This isn't rocket science. Anyone who's seen Al Gore's film, An Inconvenient Truth, will remember how he puts up a chart and shows how with various existing measures that are totally consistent with the vibrant economy, you can take a developed country's greenhouse gas emissions down by 40 or 50%. And in the long term, we would actually succeed more economically by doing so, both because we'd be at the cutting edge of new technologies and we'd avoid the long-term costs that would be entailed by not acting. As Sir Nicholas Stern said in a report to the British government, every dollar invested now avoids $20 in costs 40, 45 years down the road. So this is really a no-brainer from a public policy point of view. The Harper government, I'm afraid, simply hasn't really understood. In fact, for the first year that he was Prime Minister, Stephen Harper didn't think that climate change was a political issue, that it didn't matter in electoral terms. I think he's starting to realize it's a political issue, but he is dragging his heels. And we saw this most recently and most vividly at the G8 summit in Germany, where Stephen Harper was defecting from a coalition that was seeking to put pressure on the administration, the U.S. administration of George W. Bush. And the end result of Mr. Harper's decision-making was that the G8 communique at the end of the summit was grossly ambiguous in terms of actual commitments. The only thing it did of any significance was to recognize that climate change was real and was human-caused. But apart from that, the 8 most powerful economies on the planet could not agree on anything specific. And the G8 is Canada's grandest stage. We're there by right. We should make a real difference. We could have made a difference, and Stephen Harper simply didn't do what needed to be done. And he let not just all Canadians down, but he let all of humanity down also.
Do you think his behavior on the world stage, and some will call it sycophantic, how he's catered to the Bush administration? Do you think that this is because he wants to maintain good relations with the United States? Because it seems to be that that's the thought in Canadian politics, that that's a priority of any prime minister. And I think I go back to Paul Martin's time in office, and he seemed to do the same.
Well, I think that Stephen Harper is a bit different, and that I think that he's not only trying to make and keep friends in Washington, but he does share a lot of the ideological predispositions of Mr. Bush, and that certainly is clear if one traces his public statements before he became Prime Minister. This is a man who supported Canada going to the Iraq War. This is a man who supported Canada signing on to U.S. missile defense. This is a man who claimed that climate change was a fraud and not to be believed. So there is an ideological commitment to this, but it is packaged in the traditional effort to maintain strong and friendly ties with Washington. However, what successive Canadian governments have failed to realize is that in U.S. politics, people who simply go along with you, who acquiesce, don't actually get a whole lot of respect or attention. And also, when countries do not fall into line with the United States, they're not necessarily punished. So to give you, just an example here, Mr. Chrétien and then Mr. Martin said no to George W. Bush on two very big ticket issues, the Iraq War and then missile defense, and all of the right-wing foreign policy commentators were shaking their heads and warning of dire consequences. But I challenge anyone to show me the dire consequences of those two decisions. I think we actually earned some kudos, some respect in Washington by demonstrating that we're an independent country. And certainly on the Iraq issue, we showed that our analysis was correct, while the American analysis was wrong. There are very, very many millions of Americans who wish that the United States had followed Canada's lead on Iraq by staying out of that country. And so when we make our own decisions, we make our own conclusions on the basis of our own analysis, we sometimes do better than our American neighbors. And when we differ from them on these big ticket items, they don't retaliate in any obvious or significant way. Politics in Washington is a politics that's very sort of in your face. It's one of fighting the good fight during the day and then shaking hands and forgetting about it the next day. Americans play a rough and tumble form of politics that's very distinctive from the Canadian version, which is consensual, which is long term, and which is concerned about maintaining consistency and establishing long-term trends. Americans don't work like that. And so in Washington, when we say no, they don't like it, but they respect it.
One of the neat things in the book as well, in the final chapter, you talk about a student that you had named Matthew Gillard.
Yes.
And it ends the book on a relatively optimistic note. Would you tell us his story and the sort of adventure that the two of you had on the telephone?
Absolutely. I tell that story in the book because I want to demonstrate to all my readers that they themselves can have a positive impact in the world if they try, if they believe in themselves. And Matt Gillard was a master's student of mine at the University of British Columbia. In a seminar where, among other things, we were looking at the humanitarian crisis in Darfur. And in the course of his research, Matt came across a story in a small newspaper in Kelowna, B.C., which was following on from a federal cabinet meeting that Paul Martin had held there and indicated that the federal cabinet was planning to give $20 million to the African Union for peacekeeping in Darfur. And this was in September 2004, before the Darfur crisis had achieved a lot of international prominence. But there was no record, no report of this $20 million anywhere after that single report in this Kelowna newspaper. And so Matt decided to see if he could find the $20 million. What had happened to the $20 million? And he spent a couple of days on the telephone in my office phoning up every civil servant in Ottawa who could possibly have known about the $20 million. And he didn't get very far. Most of them didn't know. Some of them were evasive. Some of them were very suspicious as to who he was and why he was asking. And then he turns to me at the end of one day and he says, I've got to phone Africa. I've got to phone the Canadian embassy in Addis Ababa in Ethiopia because someone has said that they might know. And because of the time difference between Ethiopia and Canada, Matt and I had to meet at my office at 6 a.m. the following morning so that he could actually reach the embassy while someone was still there. And when he got through, he was, the first person didn't know anything, but, she passed him on to someone else. And that second person said, well, I don't know, but I'll put you through to the, quote, person who knows, who was almost certainly the Canadian military attaché with responsibilities over northeastern Africa. And that individual quizzed Matt at some length about who he was and why he was asking, and then he laughed. And he said, well, he said, this is really curious. This is really interesting. The federal cabinet had decided in the end not to give the $20 million, but they've been receiving so many phone calls in Ottawa the last couple of days that they've changed their mind. And you should have seen this student of mine as the realization came to him that he had been personally responsible for getting $20 million to help the victims of the humanitarian crisis in Darfur, that it was him who had done it, simply through the perseverance of 2 days on the telephone. And Matt Gillard now knows that he can change the world, and there's nothing that's going to stop him now. And this is important in terms of him and in terms of me as a teacher, because I take my teaching role more importantly than anything, more seriously than anything else that I do. But it's also a lesson for all of us, not only in terms of our own behavior, but in terms of how we think about our country. You know, if we don't think that Canada matters, if we don't think Canada can make a difference, well, then it won't matter. It won't make a difference. The only way that it can actually matter is if we believe that it can matter, and then we try. And we won't always succeed. In fact, we'll probably have some spectacular failures. But I want to be the citizen of a country that I can be proud of, that's trying to do its best for humanity. And we have the incredible luxury of having, you know, 32 million highly educated people from all around the world who live in remarkable harmony. We've got this vast expanse of beautiful territory with incredible natural resources. We have this priceless international reputation for being a neutral broker of peace. We're respected. We are the closest neighbor and ally of the world's most powerful country, and yet we're still independent. All these things enable us, if we wish, to punch way above our weight. And as I said, our weight is pretty significant already.
Do you think, Professor Byers, that you're still optimistic about Canadians achieving that role, punching above our weight, under this current regime?
Well, I'm not someone who accepts that things are going to stay the way they are today. I know for a fact that Stephen Harper will not be Prime Minister of Canada forever. His time may be limited in months, it may be years. But all I know is that you can't actually make a difference in terms of public policy and foreign policy unless you come up with new ideas and advocate them. I actually think that Stephen Harper is a pretty smart man. I also think he's made some pretty serious mistakes. But I hope he reads my book. I really do. Because I think that any smart person who cares about this country will see that we can do better if we believe in ourselves and if we try.
Professor Byers, thanks so much for joining us today, and continued good luck with this book.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed talking to you.